Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Critella and Joel Lessies for their discussion on Nothing Wasted, Nothing Lost, Lessons Learned from Lived Experience. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
So welcome, everyone. I'm glad you could make it. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you so much for having me, Henry.
So a lot of you probably know Joel. For those of you who don't, though, Joel is a friend and colleague that we've been collaborating for many years. He does have something new. He's founded the Education Training Center. And it's a means of counseling people marginalized by trauma, addiction, and psychological distress. And those of you who know him, he's continued doing his work as hosting the podcast Unraveling Religion and looking at mystical and practical discussions, exploring spirituality, religion, and psychology. He founded and continues with the Ground and Sky poetry series, including Roundtable, where you just bring whatever you wish and recite, and also workshops. And we're starting an Amber Light edition of that in April, which I'm really excited about. He continues to work in his autobiography of poetry and prose entitled Odyssey of Autumn's Breath. And he has worked as a healthcare administrator, trainer, facilitator, consultant, leading the understanding of education, treatment, advocacy, especially regarding substance abuse, mental health, and medical issues. So welcome back, Joel.
I'm so excited to see you again and to see each of you and to have our talk today. I'm really excited about that. Yeah.
So in the past, we've talked about poetry and mysticism, and this one's a little different. We're really going to focus on your devotion and love of helping people in who have mental health distress. And we've touched on that in previous podcasts, but we haven't gone into it in as much depth as we think we're going to be doing today. So I'm really excited about that. And I thought we'd start with what really is behind your passion for this? How did you get into this?
Ground zero. Where do we start? How did I find myself on this path? Right. The very first steps I took onto this path. And so that's a complex question that one aspect sort of is beyond the scope of this conversation, but certainly as I incarnated into this world, what I was born into was a very discordian and chaotic environment. And immediately, when you are raised, as many people have been, more than maybe what we would assume, a caregiver that themselves has mental health distress, themselves are not healthy and healed, whole, happy, and adjusted well, the first interaction with that person began my journey with mental health distress.
So right from the start.
Right from the start.
In family of origin.
So if I could just tie this in very pointedly, that there are no accidents. I had a friend on Unraveling Religion, Gedalia Gerfine, who said, it's not like you were meant to be born in Cleveland, Ohio, and you wound up in Buffalo, New York. It's not like some gust of wind carried your soul to the wrong place. Like, you were born into where, what, when, why, and how of your experience for your mission to complete, specifically tailored for you. And so, yeah, I've had some mental health distress with good reason, but it certainly is a part of my journey and a part of my experience, which totally opens the whole field of conversation about what we're talking about today.
So for many people, they describe that as an experience that shuts them down. For you, it sounds like an experience that opened you up. Maybe right. Not right away, but eventually.
Well, so it's a great question. I mean, how did I get to this place of a vista, of a view that is panoramic and clear? It has not been an easy journey, let me assure you. There have been many people who have assisted me on my path and in my journey. There are people who've cried with me, struggled with me, who've supported me and loved me. And as I do my best to offer what I am able to give in each relationship, in each dynamic, so too I was served by many people in love to bring me to this place of understanding wholeness and health.
So in my psychiatric training, I was, let's see, this is going way back in the 70s, late 70s. And there was always this debate when dealing with people, and again, I'm not sure about your own mental health issues, but there was this debate about dealing with people with major mental health issues where the goal was to help them understand and derive meaning from it. Mm-hmm. But there was also people who couldn't tolerate that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the difference it makes is, idealistically, I guess I was coming from, well, yeah, you would think everybody would want to derive meaning from what happens to them.
Right.
But whoa, some people just can't or don't want to do that. What I learned is if you try to push that with people who can't, it's really disturbing. Yeah. If you don't do that with people who want and need to do that, right, it's equally disturbing.
Right. So yeah, in the documentary Crazy Wise, I think someone talks about there were two schools of thought a while ago, the covering and the uncovering, and the difference between them. And so I think one of the lessons that you can infer from what you just stated is that it points specifically to the fact that we are all so unique. We are all built so differently. And so in the mass expression, the mass array of different attributes of souls and the specific signature of each soul, we can sort of generalize that, yeah, there are some who don't want to know the meaning, aren't built for the meaning, and it doesn't benefit them. Well, there are others who, like me, the meaning informed everything about my healing journey.
So can you speak a little more about that? So I know you said you had a lot of help, uh-huh, people who were with you along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When did you catch on that finding the meaning was really something you had to do?
Well, I mean, from my own experience, I had at the age of when traumatic experiences, there are two types. Let's talk about this from a psychological class, like a psychological teaching. Okay. There are two forms of memory. There are many forms of memory, but there are essentially two forms of memory that I want to talk about today. One is suppressed. So it bobs under the surface of the conscious mind. You know it's there, but you're not sure. It's not looked at. It's not examined. You kind of know what happened, but you're really not sure and you don't look at it. Then there's repressed, which we can talk about a whole host of sort of like differing professional opinions about whether repressed memories exist or not. But I'm fighting if someone tells me that repressed memories don't exist, because
yeah, I'm with you.
I've experienced them directly and I know for a fact that they do. And it's actually a brilliant mechanism of our psychology, psyche, and defense mechanisms that we do not harbor insanely traumatic events in our conscious mind. They are submerged into the unconscious until our being is ready to have them reemerge and we can handle or deal with them. So those are the two types of memory, suppressed and repressed. And I just, you know, when I found from my own experience that either suppressed or repressed memories, when I don't examine them, the events affect my behavior, and I don't know why I'm acting the ways in which I'm acting. I'm acting out. You could say I'm acting out, saying things and doing things that are not what I really is in alignment with my true self, and can be hurtful and harmful to people when I say mean things, because I'm hurting and I don't know why I feel this way, but I just have to express this in this way because I'm disjointed in my organic experience, that I'm not whole, healthy, healed, and kind of like valuing my organic insights in myself, my organic phenomenological experiences.
So we just finished a short introduction to something we're developing in Amberlite called Revisioning the Ego. And yeah, we talked exactly about that. So for, you know, the take I have is very much like you're saying, and what I wanted to really resonate with is repressed impulses, memories, whatever you want to call them, have a lot of power. There's a use for it, as you said. I agree with you completely. But even when it's doing something helpful, like waiting for you to have the capacity to be able to deal with it, it's not like it's not leading you to do things.
Well, I think it points exactly for that reason to why meaning is important, because until I had a context for my behaviors and a reason why I was acting the way that I was acting, I didn't understand myself. So as I derived a context for the events that were causing me to behave in XYZ ways, and I dug deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, I could see very clearly not just that these lost memories and lost experiences were driving my behavior, but there was wisdom in them that when I went deeply enough, I could begin to extract, and that wisdom became an offering of service to the community, which now I can guide people who have experienced in whatever measure trauma or memory issues of repressed or suppressed or just any kind of distress. Like I'm able to guide people now because of these experiences. So I look at my early childhood and adolescence as a kind of training, a kind of psychological training, like, you know, no PhD, no thank you, but am I well-versed in it? Yeah, I know it like the back of my hand. So, yeah.
So this may be jumping the gun a little bit, but there's an intersection, it sounds like, well, I know from knowing you, of the psychological piece and the spiritual mystical piece.
Yeah.
Should we speak about that now?
Let's do that. What do we want? How do we want to begin that talk?
Well, when I trained as a psychiatrist, the mental health profession was really phobic.
Yeah.
About spirituality. It started to change before I retired.
Yeah.
But even then, it was, well, you have to, I'm going to exaggerate a little, but spirituality is important to some people's life, so you have to ask them about it. But there was such a paranoia about that's going to open Pandora's box and you're going to try to convert people to what your belief system is.
Yeah.
That it was really hard to get beyond that.
Sure.
So there was a separation, at least in my training early on, from psychology and spirituality. And of course, most people know that Freud thought that religion was just a neurosis and an infantile complex. So it was actually, I never really felt that or saw that in my training. But that was probably before my time. But there was at least a split. When I did my training as a spiritual guide, the initial part is it was the same split, but on the other side. They were terrified of talking about psychology, in part because there was a fear that spiritual guides would turn into therapists when they didn't have the qualifications to do that.
Right.
And that started to change.
Right.
I had something to do with that, but certainly not just me. So I've always been fascinated. I don't think you can do either one without the other.
You cannot. It's not possible. It's just not possible. I mean, you know, I mean, let's look at it objectively. Let's look at why that would be the case objectively. Why isn't the physical just dealing with what we call the misnomer of a brain disorder? Is it a brain disorder? Is mental health a brain disorder when it doesn't function properly? Well, maybe it is. Isn't that just one side of a coin, though? I mean, we are matter. We are physical. We have a body. We have a rice. We are rice bags. We're in this incarnation, this body. But that's only half of the equation. The other half is that we are beyond time and space, and an essence of something that is transcendent. And we merge that limitless aspect, that unnameable aspect, into this physical container. And so if you look just at the brain disorder of the physical, okay, that may be the case. And you may be able to take a pill and quell some of the symptoms, but like why we are here, what and why we are doing here, the deeper questions are a part of that limitlessness, the soul. And so if you're not looking at that as what, and people are very fearful, just as you said, each on the other side is fearful of the other. But like, what we need are people to fearlessly examine this human condition, scrutinize it. What is my mental health, my physical health, and my spiritual health? And my spiritual health is definitely tied into my mental health and my physical health, because everything here, and we all know this in differing levels of understanding, everything here is a matter of energy. Like, our intentionality for life is what we experience. And when we put forth beautiful intention for service for others and kindness and compassion and courtesy, that returns to us like in kind and beauty and good feelings and validity of our experiences. And the opposite is true when we are agended with our intention. When we say we try to utilize our intention to secure some kind of agenda in our human condition that we think we want or are entitled to, that doesn't feel so good. And we know that. So the foundation of all this is energy. And that's what we are, is energy. We are in a form of consciousness. That's part of the human experience, but the body is also part of the human experience. The moderate vantage point or perspective is an understanding of both, the totality of both. And that's really why I feel like we talked about when I first experienced mental health distress, it's as soon as I incarnated, but that's not without reason. That's not without purpose. And what I'm expressing now is a manifestation of that mission and purpose, that I understand that it's a blending of the physical and the spiritual.
So it sounds like you started with, like we did with this podcast, the psychology of it. And we're making an artificial, I'm not sure I can make the distinction anymore between, I'm not saying it quite right. I don't think you can have real spirituality without paying attention to psychology and vice versa. But for purposes of discussion, it sounded like at first you were dealing with it more from a psychological vantage point, and somehow it informed your developing spiritual opening and awareness.
Well, I love this is a very sensitive question. And how I want to answer it is it's a curiosity. We talked about each soul has its own signature or attributes or desires or mission. I have always been, as soon as I was exposed to mystical elements or deeper elements or spiritual elements in life, I was not exposed to them throughout high school. Not even until after college was I really ripe to receive them. But I began, as soon as I could, when I read The Snow Leopard, began to build a framework of understanding about the spiritual dimensions of my existence and of existence in general. And that foundation, that perspective, that building of a spiritual contextual framework, which I framed in the beginning talking about there's no accidents that I'm born into this incarnation with reason and purpose, is very much tied into the mystical or spiritual understanding of things. So that the mystical or spiritual framework drew me out of the psychological distress, because I knew I had faith that my journey was not for naught, that it was informed and I was here with a purpose and had faith that I would find meaning, although it was hidden from me, concealed from me in different ways at different points within my incarnation, within these experiences as Joel.
One of the Sufi masters, Pir Vilayat Inayat Khan, he has some teachings on spirituality and counseling. And just to paraphrase it, he was basically saying you have to kick it up a level, which is almost what I think you're saying. That sometimes you just deal with it, for you at least, or for people like us, you deal with it at a psychological level and it's not quite enough. You have to kick it up a level and all of a sudden, there's more meaning and you have a bigger context in which to hold your experiences. And that could be really healing.
It can be, because I'll tell you, the place that I'm at now with spirituality and practical experiences in life, there's zero distinction. That fully, if you want to be the most mystical, you are present without any trace of spirituality. There's no stink of Zen. There's no stink of, I am a spiritual person. We each are, I don't know how to say it, endowed with the original nature. And so in differing levels of forgetfulness and differing levels of concealment, our lack of recognition of what we truly are informs our journey and hinders our journey, but we are all making that movement toward awakening. We are all making the movement toward recognizing that we are spirit soul in a physical container. All of us, without distinction, without prejudice, every single being will come to this realization. Every single being will come to this awakening that I too am endowed with Buddha nature.
So, you know, it's fascinating. I had a laugh when you said the stink of Zen. So one of the movement, a very popular movement in psychology, which I really have grown to love, is the positive psychology movement. And it's the other side of the coin of what you're saying. So from a psychological approach, it's saying, here are the qualities that will make you happy and make your life more meaningful. And they're the same things that you're learning about in Zen or Sufism or Buddhism or Christianity. And George Valent, who's an expert on human development, he's a Freudian analyst initially trained, which makes me laugh even more. The book's a little old now, but he wrote a book called Spiritual Evolution, which really caught my attention. And he takes a positive psychology framework, and he says, this is spirituality. Yeah. Actualizing these psychological traits is spirituality.
Yeah, I take the slant a little bit differently, Henry. And I would say this, it's not a big distinction, it's a small distinction. But in the Talmud, in Torah, there's the oral tradition and the written tradition. The written tradition is the Bible, is the Torah, the written books of Moses and writings and prophets and all that. But there's the oral tradition, which was codified in the Talmud. And in the Talmud, it says, who is wealthy? Who is rich? He who is content with their lot. He who is sitting in the moment, every moment, understanding and seeing that what they have. What do they have? There's nothing they don't have. It's just what they identify with that prevents them from understanding that. So what do I mean by that? He who is content with their lot, they who are content with their lot, means very much you are inherently this moment. You are not separate from this moment. Therefore, you are this moment. And there's nothing that you do not access or have at your disposal that you need, that you don't need. So like the fullness of the spiritual experience is to have mushin or no mind, no-mindedly just being like a cat. You know, cats are terrific Zen masters. But this mushin or no mind eliminates distinction as well. Distinctions between I am Joel and you are Henry, or I am an executive director of education training center, or I am a man. Like in this place of deep understanding, there is no thought, there is no belief, there is no construct, there is no identity. And so you don't need to, there's nothing to be added to this experience. There's nothing that you can become that you aren't already so fully that it requires nothing else.
It sounds very Zen.
Well, you know, so when you say that, what are you asking or what are you implying? You're implying that there's a tradition that expresses these very deep understandings and teachings, but this is inherent birthright for all beings.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Zen is a drag race, a sprint to this understanding in a certain kind of way, more than maybe others. Different practices lend themselves to different qualities and benefits, but this deep awakening of what we are tends to be very precipitated by Zen practice. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like Zen reminds me that you're trying, it's a sprint to use your word to make sure you don't go anywhere because you're already there. Which is an interesting paradox.
Let's look at truth. What is true or what is truth? That is the truth. So then the question becomes, what is blocking my vision or understanding or perception of truth? If I am everything, why do I not understand that and experience that? You know, the Zen master Dogen had this very question. All beings are enlightened. Why don't they understand that they are enlightened? Why do we need to sit in Zazen to understand that we are awakened self?
So in your experience, how did your mental health experiences help you with all that?
Oh, I love this question. This is like the most beautiful question ever, because with the repressed memories, I went to Israel. I went on a 10-month social services program, Project Otzma. There I did a lot of introspection work because I had some really serious traumatic experiences in high school, which were totally discordian, meaning pure chaos and brutal and unspeakable. And I repressed those memories as soon as they happened. But I went after college, I went on this 10-month social services program. I had had enough time and distance from the experiences. So I began to do introspection very seriously. And out of that introspection began this question in me, because my experience was not organic, whole, healthy, and healed. My question became, what is the matter with me? And that question became a koan. So koan is an illogical question. It formed in China. Koans formed in China in Buddhism, in Chan, to awaken the student by shattering all conceptions of identity and construct in the mind. The illogical question shatters the constructs of belief and rational thought, discursive thought, to open beings up to the sheer presence of what they are, the sheer truth of what they are. And so my koan became, what is the matter with me? And this koan blew all the doors and windows out of my mind. Like, I just awoke at 24, and it was only the beginning of my journey. I mean, I had so much work to do. Only now have I really closed much of the suffering and trauma that I had experienced from birth to about 18. So it's directly tied. The mental health, the stress, and the spiritual inquiry are not different. They're the same thing. It's just that when we look through the lens of psychiatry, I've had so many different kinds of diagnoses. They've labeled me X, Y, and Z. And finally, because I've resolved things in a way, they can look back and in hindsight say, oh, this was a complex post-traumatic stress disorder. It was nothing else. But the symptoms, as you will appreciate, Henry, exhibited as if it were bipolar or schizoaffective or schizophrenia or whatever. But it was none of those things, because I don't, now that I've digested my trauma, I have none of those symptoms any longer. So it wasn't some organic illness. I was dealing with very complex trauma.
One of the points that we made about wanting to discuss were the lessons you learned from trauma.
Yeah.
Can you speak about that?
Lessons that I learned from trauma?
Mm-hmm.
I want to start by addressing this question by, you know, we have a mission and a purpose. I'm at this time and place. I could not imagine myself without these experiences. I'm so grateful for what those assholes taught me. I'm so grateful that those difficulties came to me, because it extracted something in my deep self that would not have come out otherwise. It was a test of my worth and my truth. So people who did harm to me, I honor them as teachers and they can go on their way. But I'm also grateful for what I've learned. The depth of my experience now is informed by those very difficult experiences. And the lessons of trauma are many. Marginalization, to be marginalized in a body and in a condition as a white male in America that you think I'd be mainstreamed in, I am. And I've had many, many things open for me because I am a white man. But I will also tell you that within that was a silent suffering of marginalization, which once I began to extract the understanding of that, I can identify now very deeply with marginalized peoples and groups and identities. Because, you know, I had experiences that marginalized me from mainstream conventional markers.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main lesson of the trauma, is that it informed me to be sensitive to marginalization.
So I wanted to back up, because you said something really poignant, that you're able to appreciate that you couldn't be the person you are without having gone through those experiences.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound like I've had trouble with the phrase forgive and forget.
Yeah.
I tend to be more like forgive and not forget.
I couldn't agree with you more. There is no reason to forget when people are assholes. You know, there's no reason to forget that. I mean, you can forgive to let go of the energies and the ties and honor that. You know, let's talk about it from this lens. Like, You know, I took a very important instruction from the New Testament, because when Jesus was in front of, I don't know if it was Pontius or whatever, but, you know, Jesus informs him that, you know, he's like, dude, you would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. I learned a lot from that, because I think that that is true of all of our circumstances. And so when we forgive, what are we doing? We're saying that it's not necessarily that person and me, but this has been orchestrated for my growth. So I don't need to hold on to it, and I don't need to have grudges against you for what you've done to me. That's between you and God. And the lessons that I can extract from these experiences, that's between me and God. And my work is to extract the lessons of the trauma to benefit others, by as a guide, as providing a roadmap on how to heal. And in that way, you know, I can forgive what David did to me and what other people have done to me. Certainly, I harbor no ill will and no grudge. You know, may all their ill intention return to them like in kind as they expressed it. But I adhere to God. I adhere to the one that I feel protects and guides and is good. And so I have no problems remembering what they did to me, but I forgive them.
I think that's so important.
Yeah.
I think the forgetting piece is a mistake, because you don't learn if you don't remember.
Yeah.
But you can have the memory, but not hold on to the trauma, the emotional trauma. And that's what, if I hear you correctly, that's what you've been able to do and help other people do.
Yeah. And I think it's good. You know, there are a lot of dangers in this world. There are a lot of dangerous people in this world. So if you're forgiving and forgetting, and you're forgetting that this person is dangerous, you're bound to repeat that experience. But to forgive and remember is a much healthier way to go about things. He said, that's been my experience, you know.
Right, that's been my experience too. It is kind of funny that, you know, in mental health, you try so hard to unlock the repressed memories so they don't drive you. But then there's kind of this expectation, oh, now that you've unlocked them, you need to forget them. No, you remember them and you integrate them.
Yeah.
When you're able to do that, right?
The way I describe my experiences to people that have not experienced trauma, it's like I visited a country that you can never imagine, that's real, that you can never imagine and you can never visit. And I may tell you about what the experiences were like, but it's no replacement for the experiences themselves. You know, I mean, those things informed me in a way and shaped me in a way that was brutal and terrifying and horrific, but also because of whatever grace was present in my life, now I see it as beautiful and a kind of like gift that was given to me by the universe. And I say that unequivocally, and that's not a quip. Like, that's my deepest experience and understanding.
You know, it's a very hopeful story.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, not that I haven't worked my ass off. I've worked my ass off. I have worked my ass off to get to this place. I'm 53 and don't have many of the things that people on conventional trajectories have. I don't have a marriage. I don't have children. Those are things that I part of me would have liked, but I accept that this is the price of what I was required to do in this incarnation.
Even that context is very hopeful and helpful.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound, the way you describe it, it doesn't even sound like, I'm struggling with the right word. It's not even a resignation. It's an understanding of, oh, this is who I am and that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you come out of seeing what I've seen and you're at this level of like health. To me, I infer directly from that the universe has faith in me and who I am, because it sent me into difficult conditions and brought me through. And so there's a kind of confidence that the universe has in me that sent me on a difficult mission. You know, I have a friend who has DID, and DID is dissociative identity disorder. It's what used to be called multiple personality disorder. And they have multiple identities, and sometimes they lose track of time, and they struggle, and they're such a hardworking, fierce kind of like person. But I tell them, you know, as I feel for myself, I tell them, because I feel that this is true. I don't say it just to make them feel better, but I feel like, you know, it's kind of funny, but I say, You're on special assignment. You know, you've been given this assignment. You're on special assignment.
Right. I think that dovetails a question came in about, have you thought about how your path has affected other people?
Well, you know, there's this tendency in our culture to, and I want to take this in my own direction, but like, there's a tendency in our culture to measure how we affect things, like our identity, our role, our responsibility, our title. You know, I've impacted X, Y, Z. And I think that that's important in our culture. It's a measure of how we relate to others and how we establish like who is what and what. There are other cultures that have a different level of understanding where your life, your incarnation, your mode of service is an offering to community, which may be reflected back to you from time to time, but it's not something that you consider yourself as having done. Like you just keep moving forward and you don't really tie into an identity that I have affected X, Y, Z. And I adhere to the latter. I like that idea of like moving moment to moment, giving all I can of my heart to each person that I see in the ways that I can and just keep moving forward, keep growing, keep evolving, keep understanding, keep deepening, and giving what I can to who I can in the ways that I can and not really counting or measuring. So I don't mean to discount the question because it's a good question, but that's just my genuine response.
So there's a paradox in that, because one of the ways that we gauge some of those qualities or being more in touch with who we really are or the Buddha nature that you talked about is the vibrations we send out into the world and what happens around us.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you get too focused on, well, I need to see what effect I had in the world around me, and it gets in the way of that.
Right.
It's a real interesting paradox. And some of the studies we've been doing, the phrase that we keep using that we've actually taken from David Spangler is sovereignty, where you are centered in, this is it. This is who I am, and this is what I'm meant to do.
And
from the Sufi point of view, the phrase that's often used is independence and indifference. Take it too far, it sounds callous.
Right.
I don't care. I could care less what happens to you. I'm only interested in me. That's not it.
No, nor is it the reverse. Nor is it that I care solely about how other people perceive me.
Correct. But that's an interesting line to be, line is the wrong word, but I can feel it. Putting it into words so it's not misunderstood, I think it's a felt experience.